Get ready to jump back into the hole if this gets too hot. Otherwise, initiate the standard distract and destroy. The clatter of alien hooves on marble echoed behind a door to their right. The Spartans melted into the shadows. The Master Chief crouched behind a crate and unsheathed his combat knife. The door opened, and four jackals stood in the doorframe. They held active energy shields in front of them, warping their already ugly vulture faces. The blue-white glow of the energy shield pulsed through the dark chamber. Good, the Master Chief thought. That should play hell with their night vision. The jackals held plasma pistols at the ready in their free hands. The barrels of the guns moved erratically as the aliens whispered to one another, then steadied as, in careful, slow movements, they moved in. The aliens fanned out into a rough delta formation, the lead jackal a meter ahead of his compatriots. The group approached the Master Chief's hiding spot. There was a slight noise, the clink of glass bottles on the other side of the room. The jackals turned and presented their unshielded backs to the Master Chief. He exploded from his hiding place and jammed his blade into the base of the closest jackal's back. He snapped his right foot out, caught the back of the next jackal's head, crushing its skull. The remaining aliens spun, glistening energy shields interposed between them and him. There were three coughs from silenced MA-5Bs. Alien blood, black in the harsh blue-white light, spattered across the inner surfaces of the energy shields as the silence rounds found their marks. The jackals toppled to the ground. The Master Chief policed their plasma pistols and retrieved the shield generators clamped on their forearms. He had standing orders to collect intact specimens of Covenant technology. The Office of Naval Intelligence had not been able to replicate the Covenant's shield technology. But they were getting close. In the meantime, the Spartans would use these. The Master Chief strapped the curved piece of metal to his forearm. He touched one of the two large buttons on the unit, and a scintillating film appeared before him. He handed the other shield devices to his teammates. He pressed the second button, and the shield collapsed. "Don't use these unless you have to," he said. "The humming and their reflective surfaces might give us away, and we don't know how long they last." He got three acknowledgement lights. Kelly and Fred took up positions on either side of the open door. She gave him a thumbs up. Kelly took point, and the Spartans moved, single file, up a circular stairwell. She paused a full 10 seconds at the doorway to the main floor. She waved them ahead, and they emerged on the main level of the museum. The skeleton of a blue whale was suspended over the main foyer. The dead hulk reminded the Master Chief of a Covenant starship. He turned away from the distraction and slowly moved over the black marble tiles. Oddly, there were no more jackal patrols. There were 100 jackals outside guarding the place, but none inside. The Master Chief didn't like it. It didn't feel right, and Chief Mendez had told him 1,000 times to trust his instincts. Was it a trap? The Spartans staggered their line and moved cautiously into the east wing. There were displays of the local flora and fauna, gigantic flowers and fist-sized beetles, but their motion sensors were cold. Fred halted, and then with a quick hand signal, waved John to move up to his position. He stood by a case of pinned butterflies. On the floor, face down in front of that case, was a jackal. It was dead, crushed flat. There was an imprint of a large boot where the creature's back had been. Whatever had done this had easily weighed a ton. The Master Chief spotted a few blood-smeared prints leading away from the jackal and into the west wing. He flipped on his infrared sensors and took a long look around. No heat sources here or in the nearby rooms. The Master Chief followed the footprints and signaled the team to follow. The west wing held scientific displays. There were static electric generators and quantum field holograms on the walls, a tapestry of darting arrows and wriggling lines. A cloud chamber sat in the corner, with subatomic tracers zipping through its misty confines. The Master Chief noted it was unusually active. This place reminded him of Deja's classroom on Reach. a branch opened to another wing. The word geology was carved on the entry arch. Through that arch there was a strong infrared source, a razor-thin line that shot straight up and out of the building. The Master Chief only caught a glimpse of the thing, a wink and blink, then it was gone again. It was so bright, his IR sensors overloaded and automatically shut down. He waved James to take the left side of the arch. He had Kelly and Fred drop back to cover their flanks, and the Master Chief edged to the right of the arch. He sent a fiber-optic probe ahead, bent it slightly, and poked it around the corner. The room contained display cases of mineral specimens. There were sulfur crystals, raw emeralds, and rubies. There was a monolith of unpolished pink quartz in the center of the room, 3 meters wide and 6 tall. Off to one side, however, were two creatures. The Master Chief hadn't seen them at first, because they were so motionless and so massive. He had no doubt that one of them had crushed the jackal that had gotten in his way. The Master Chief got scared all the time. He never showed it, though. He usually mentally acknowledged the apprehension, put it aside, and continued, just as he'd been trained to do. This time, however, he couldn't easily dismiss the feeling. The two creatures were vaguely man-shaped. They stood 2.5 meters tall. It was difficult to make out their features. They were covered from head to toe with a dull blue-gray armor, similar to the hull of a Covenant ship. Blue, orange, and yellow highlights were visible on the few patches of exposed skin the creatures sported. They had slits where their eyes should be. The articulation points looked impregnable. On their left arms, they hefted large shields, thick as starship battle plate. Mounted on their right arms were massive, wide-barreled weapons, so large that the arm beneath seemed to blend into the weapon. They moved with slow deliberation. One took a rock from the display case and set it inside a red metal case. It bent over the case, while the other turned and touched the control panel of a device that looked like a small pulse laser turret. The laser pointed straight up and out through the shattered glass dome overhead. That had been the source of the infrared radiation. The laser must have intermittently scattered off the dust in the air, flashed enough energy into his sensors to burn them out. Something that powerful could beam a message straight into space. The Master Chief made a slow fist, the signal for his team to freeze. Then, with slow, deliberate movements, he signaled the Spartans to stay alert and get ready. He waved Fred and Kelly forward. Fred crept closer to him. Kelly slid up next to James. The Master Chief then held up 2 fingers and made a sideways cut, motioning them into the room. Acknowledgement lights winked on. He went in first, sidestepped to the right, with Fred at his side. James and Kelly took the left flank. They opened fire. Armor-piercing rounds pinged off the alien's body armor. One of them turned and brought its shield in front of it, covering its partner, the red case, and the laser beacon. The Spartan bullets didn't even leave a scratch on the armor. The alien raised its arm slightly and pointed at Kelly and James. A flash of light blinded the Master Chief. There was a deafening explosion and a wave of heat. He blinked for a full 3 seconds before he recovered his vision. Where Kelly and James had been, there was a burning crater that fanned backward. Nothing but charcoal and ash remained of the science chamber behind them. Kelly had moved in time. She crouched 5 meters deeper into the room, still firing. James was nowhere to be seen. The other massive creature turned to face the Master Chief. He hit the button on the shield generator on his arm and brought it up just in time. The nearest alien's weapon flashed again. The air in front of the Master Chief shimmered and exploded. He flew backward, crashing through the wall, and skidded for 10 meters before slamming into the wall of the next room. The Jackal shield generator was white hot. The Master Chief ripped the melted alien device off and threw it away. Those plasma bolts were like nothing he had seen before. They seemed almost as powerful as the stationary plasma cannons the Jackals used. The Master Chief sprang to his feet and charged back into the chamber. If the aliens' weapons were similar to Covenant plasma guns, they would need to be recharged. He hoped the Spartans had enough time to take those things out. The Master Chief still felt the fear. It was stronger than it had been before, but his team was still in there. He had to take care of them first before he could indulge in the luxury of feelings. Kelly and Fred circled the creatures, their silenced weapons firing quick bursts. They ran out of ammunition and switched clips. This wasn't working. They couldn't take them out. Maybe a jackhammer missile at point-blank range would penetrate their armor. The Master Chief's gaze was drawn to the center of the room. He stared for a moment at the monolith of pink quartz. Over the comm channel, he ordered, "Switch to shredder rounds!" He changed ammunition and then opened fire at the floor underneath the enormous creature's feet. Kelly and Fred changed rounds and fired too. Marble tiles shattered, and the wood underneath splintered into toothpicks. One of the creatures raised its arm again, preparing to fire.
"Keep shooting!" John yelled.
The floor creaked, buckled, and then fell away. The two massive aliens plunged into the basement below.
"Quick!"
the Master Chief said. He slung his rifle and moved to the back of the quartz monolith.
"Push!"
Kelly and Fred leaned their weight against the stone and grunted with effort. The slab moved a tiny bit. James sprinted forward, slammed into the stone, put his shoulder alongside theirs, and pushed. His left arm had been burned away from the elbow down, but he didn't even whimper. The monolith moved. It inched toward the hole, then tilted and went over. It landed with a dull thud and a crunching noise. The Master Chief peered over the edge. He saw an armored left leg, and on the other side of the stone slab, an arm struggling underneath. The things were still alive. Their motion slowed, but they didn't cease. The red case was balanced precariously on the edge of the hole. It teetered, no way to reach it in time. He turned to Kelly, the fastest Spartan, and yelled,
"Grab it!"
The box fell, and Kelly leaped. In a single bound, she caught the rock as the case dropped. She tucked, rolled, and got to her feet, the rock safely held in one hand. She handed it to the Master Chief. The rock was a piece of granite and glittered with a few jewel-like inclusions. What was so special about it? He stuffed it into his ammunition sack and then kicked over the Covenant transmission beacon. Outside, the Master Chief heard the clattering and squawking of the army of jackals and grunts.
"Let's get out of here, Spartans."
He threw his arm around James and helped him along. They ran into the basement, making sure to give the pinned giants under the stone a wide berth, then jumped through the storm drain and into the sewers. They jogged through the muck and didn't stop until they had cleared the drain system and emerged in the rice paddies on the edge of Côte d'Azur. Fred rigged the ground-returned relay to the pipes overhead and ran a crude antenna outside. The Master Chief looked back at the city. Banshee flyers circled through the skyscrapers. Spotlights from the hovering Covenant transport ships bathed the streets in blue illumination. The grunts were going crazy. Their barks and screams rose to an impenetrable din. The Spartans moved toward the coast and followed the tree line south. James collapsed twice along the way, and then finally slipped into unconsciousness. The Master Chief slung him over his shoulder and carried him. They paused and hid when they heard a patrol of a dozen grunts. The aliens ran past them. They either didn't see the Spartans, or they didn't care. The animals sprinted as fast as they could back to the city. When they were a click away from the rendezvous point, the Master Chief opened the comm link.
"Green team leader, we're on your perimeter and coming in, signaling with blue smoke."
"Ready and waiting for you, sir," Linda replied. "Welcome back."
The Master Chief set off one of his smoke grenades, and they marched into the clearing. The Pelican was intact. Corporal Harland and his Marines stood post, and the rescued civilians were safely inside the ship. Blue and red teams were hidden in the nearby brush and trees. Linda approached them. She motioned for her team to take James and get him onto the Pelican.
"Sir," she said, "all civilians on board and ready for liftoff."
The Master Chief wanted to relax, sit down, and close his eyes. But this was often the most dangerous part of any mission, those last few steps when you might let down your guard.
Good. Take one more look around the perimeter. Let's make double sure nothing followed us back.
Yes, sir.
Corporal Harland approached and saluted.
Sir, how did you do it? Those civilians said you got them out of the city, past an army of Covenant, sir. How?
John cocked his head quizzically.
It was our mission, Corporal, he said. The corporal stared at him, and then at the other Spartans.
Yes, sir.
When Green Team Leader reported that the perimeter was clear, the last of the Spartans boarded the Pelican. James had regained consciousness. Someone had removed his helmet and propped his head on a folded survival blanket. His eyes watered from the pain, but he managed to salute the Master Chief with his left hand. John gestured at Kelly. She administered a dose of painkiller, and James lapsed into unconsciousness. The Pelican lifted into the air. In the distance, the suns were warming the horizon, and Côte d'Azur was outlined against the dawn. The dropship suddenly accelerated at full speed straight up and then angled away to the south.
Sir, the pilot said over the comm channel, we're getting multiple incoming radar contacts, about 200 Banshees inbound.
We'll take care of it, Lieutenant, John replied.
Prepare for EMP and shockwave.
The Master Chief activated his remote radio transceiver. He quickly keyed in the final failsafe code, then sent the coded burst transmission on its way. A third sun appeared on the horizon. It blotted out the light of the system's stars, then cooled from amber to red, and darkened the sky with black clouds of dust. Mission accomplished, he said.
Chapter 23 0500 Hours, July 18, 2542, Military Calendar. UNSC Iroquois, Military Staging Area in orbit around Sigma Octanus IV. Captain Keyes leaned against the brass railing on the bridge of the Iroquois and surveyed the devastation. The space near Sigma Octanus IV was littered with debris. The dead hulks of Covenant and UNSC ships spun lazily in the vacuum, surrounded by clouds of wreckage, jagged pieces of decimated armor plate, shattered single-ship fuselages, and heat-blackened metal fragments created a million radar targets. The debris field would clutter this system and make for a navigational hazard for the next decade. They had recovered nearly all the bodies from space. Captain Key's gaze caught the remnants of the cradle as the blasted space dock spun past. The kilometer-wide plate was now safely locked in a high orbit around the planet. She was slowly being torn apart from her own rotation. Girders and metal plates warped and bent as the gravitational stresses on the ship increased. The Covenant plasma weapons had burned through 10 decks of super-hard metal and armor like so many layers of tissue paper. 30 volunteers on the repair station had died piloting the unwieldy craft. Admiral Stanforth had gotten his win, but at a tremendous cost. Keyes brought up the casualty figures and damage estimates on his data pad. He scowled as the data scrolled across his screen. The UNSC had lost more than 20 ships, and those that survived had all suffered heavy damage. Most would require months of time-consuming repair at a shipyard. Nearly 1,000 people were killed in the battle, and hundreds more were wounded, many critically. Add to that the 1,600 marine casualties on the surface, and the 300,000 civilians murdered in Côte d'Azur at the hands of the Covenant. Some win, Keyes thought bitterly. Côte d'Azur was now a smoldering crater, but Sigma Octanus IV was still a human-held world. They had saved everyone else on the planet, nearly 13 million souls. So perhaps it had been worth it. So many lives and deaths had been measured in this battle. Had the balance of the odds tipped slightly against them, everything could have been lost. That was something he had never taught any of his students at the academy, how much victory depended on luck as well as skill. Captain Keyes saw the last of the marine dropships returning from the planet's surface. They docked with the Leviathan, and then the huge carrier turned and accelerated out of the system.
Sensor sweep complete, Lieutenant Dominique reported.
I think that was the last of the lifeboats we picked up, sir.
Let's make certain, Lieutenant, Keyes replied. One more pass through the system, please. Ensign Lovell, plot a course and take us around again.
Yes, sir, Lovell wearily replied.
The bridge crew was exhausted, physically and emotionally. They had all pulled extended shifts as they searched for survivors. Captain Keyes would rotate shifts after this next pass. As he looked at this crew, he noticed that something was different. Lieutenant Hikawa's movements were crisp and determined, as if everything she did now would decide their next battle. It made a startling contrast to her normally lethargic efficiency. Lieutenant Hall's false exuberance had been replaced by genuine confidence. Dominique almost seemed happy, his hands lightly typing a report to Fleetcom. Even Ensign Lovell, despite his exhaustion, stepped lively. Maybe Admiral Stanforth was right. Maybe the fleet needed this win more than he had realized. They had beaten the Covenant. Although not widely known, there had only been 3 small engagements in which the UNSC fleet had decisively defeated the Covenant. And not since Admiral Cole had retaken Harvest Colony had there been an engagement on this scale. A complete victory. A world saved. It would show everyone that winning was possible. That there was hope. But, he mused, was there really? They won because they had gotten lucky, and had twice as many ships as the Covenant. And, he suspected, they had beaten the Covenant because the Covenant's real objective hadn't been to win. Naval intelligence officers had come aboard the Iroquois immediately after the battle. They congratulated Captain Keyes on his performance, and then copied and purged every single bit of data they had intercepted from the Covenant planet-side transmission. Of course, the ONI spooks left without offering any explanation. Keyes toyed with his pipe, replaying the battle in his mind. No. The Covenant had lost because they were really after something else on Sigma Octanus IV, and the intercepted message was the key.
Sir, Lieutenant Dominique said, incoming orders from Fleetcom.
Put it through to my station, Lieutenant, Captain Keyes said as he sat in his command chair.
The computer scanned his retina and fingerprints and then decoded the message. He read on the small monitor.
United Nations Space Command Priority Transmission, 09872 Hotel-908. Encryption read. Public key, file/Lightning Matrix 4. From Admiral Michael Stanforth, Commanding Officer, UNSC Leviathan, UNSC Sector 3 Commander, UNSC Service Number 00834-19223, Hotel Sierra. 2. Captain Jacob Keyes, Commanding Officer, UNSC Iroquois, UNSC Service Number 01928-19912, Juliet Kilo. Subject, orders for your immediate consideration. Classification, secret, BGX directive. Start file. Keyes. Drop whatever you're doing and head back to the barn. We're both wanted for immediate debriefing by ONI at Reach Headquarters, ASAP. Looks like the spooks at Naval Intelligence are up to their normal cloak-and-dagger tricks. Cigars and brandy afterward. Regards, Stanforth.
Very well, he muttered to himself. Lieutenant Dominique, send Admiral Stanforth my compliments. Ensign Lovell, generate a randomized vector as per the Cole protocol and make ready to leave system. Take us out for an hour in slipstream space, then we'll reorient and proceed to the Reach military installation.
Aye, sir. Randomized jump vector ready. Our tracks are covered.
Lieutenant Hall, start organizing shore leave for the crew. We're heading back for repairs and some well-deserved R&R.
Amen to that, Ensign Lovell said.
That wasn't technically in his orders, but Captain Keyes would make sure his crew got the rest they deserved. That was the least he could do for them. The Iroquois slowly accelerated on an out-system vector. Captain Keyes took one long last look at Sigma Octanus IV. The battle was over. So why did he feel like he was headed into another fight? The Iroquois plowed through a haze of titanium dust, condensed from a UNSC battle plate vaporized by Covenant plasma.
The fine particles caught the light from Sigma Octanus and sparkled red and orange, making it look like the destroyer sailed through an ocean of blood. When there was time, a hazmat team would sweep the area and clean up. In the meantime, junk, ranging in size from microscopic up to 30-meter sections of cradle, still drifted in the system. One piece of debris in particular floated near the Iroquois. It was small, almost indistinguishable from any of a thousand other softball-sized blobs that cluttered radar scopes and polluted thermal sensors. If anyone had been looking close enough, however, they would have seen that this particular piece of metal drifted in the opposite direction from all the other masses nearby. It trailed behind the accelerating Iroquois and edged closer, moving with purpose. When it was close enough, it extended tiny electromagnets that guided it to the baffles at the base of the Iroquois' number 3 engine shield. It blended in perfectly with the other vanadium steel components. The object opened a single photo eye and gazed at the stars, collecting data to reference its current position. It would continue to do this for several days. During that time, it would slowly build up a charge. When it reached critical energy, a tiny sliver of thallium nitride memory crystal would be ejected at nearly the speed of light, and a minute slipstream field would generate around it. If its trajectory was perfect, it would intercept a Covenant receiver located at precise coordinates in the alternate space, and the tiny automated probe would reveal to the Covenant every place the Iroquois had been. Chapter 24. 1100 hours, August 12, 2542, Military Calendar. Epsilon Eridani System. Reach UNSC Military Complex, Planet Reach, Camp Hathcock. The Master Chief steered the Warthog to the fortified gate and ignored the barrel of the chain gun that was not quite pointed in his direction. The guard on duty, a Marine corporal, saluted smartly when John handed over his identification card.
"Sir, welcome to Camp Hathcock," the corporal said. "Follow this road to the inner guard post and present your credentials there. They'll direct you to the main compound."
John nodded. The Warthog's tires crunched on gravel as the massive metal gate swung open. Nestled in the highland mountains of Reach's northern continent, Camp Hathcock was a top-level retreat. Heads of state, VIPs, and top brass were the facility's normal occupants, these in a division of veteran battle-hardened Marines.
"Sir, please follow the blue road to this point here," the corporal at the inner gate instructed, gesturing at a point on a wall-mounted map. "And park in the visitor's parking area."
Minutes later, the main facility was in sight. John parked the Warthog and strode across the pleasantly familiar compound. He and the other Spartans had covertly made their way up here during their training. John suppressed a smile as he remembered how many times the young Spartans had commandeered food and supplies from the base. He inhaled deeply, smelling pinyon pines and sage. He missed this place. He had been away from Reach for too long. Reach was one of the few places that John considered safe from the Covenant. There were 100 ships and 20 Mark V Mach guns on the orbital stations overhead. Those guns were powered by fusion generators buried deep within Reach. Each Mark V could propel a projectile so massive and with such velocity, he doubted if even Covenant shields could withstand a single salvo from them. His home would not fall. Tall fences and razor wire encircled the inner compound of Camp Hathcock. The Master Chief stopped at the inner gate and saluted the MP there. The Marine MP looked over the Master Chief in his dress uniform. He snapped to attention. His mouth dropped open, and he stared unblinkingly.
"They're waiting for you, Master Chief, sir. Please go right on in."
The guard's reaction to the Master Chief and the medals on his chest was not uncommon. First word of the Spartans and their accomplishments had spread, despite the cloak of secrecy ONI had tried to surround them with. 3 years ago, the information had gone public at Admiral Stanforth's insistence, for morale purposes. It was hard to mistake the Master Chief for anything other than a Spartan. He stood just over 2 meters tall, and weighed in at 130 kilos of rock-hard muscle and iron-dense bone. There was a special insignia on his uniform as well, a golden eagle poised with its talons forward, ready to strike. The bird clutched a lightning bolt in one talon and three arrows in the other. The Spartan insignia was not the only thing about his dress uniform that called attention to him. Campaign ribbons and medals covered the left side. Chief Mendez would have been proud of him, but John had long ago stopped keeping track of the honors that had been heaped upon him. He didn't like the flashy ornamentation. He and the other Spartans preferred to be inside their Mjolnir armor. Without it, he felt exposed somehow, like he'd left his quarters without his skin. He had grown used to the enhanced speed and strength, to his thought and actions melding instantaneously. The Master Chief marched into the main building. Outwardly, it had been designed to look like a simple log cabin, albeit a large one. Its inner walls were lined with titanium A armor plate, and underground were bunkers and plush conference rooms that extended 100 meters below the earth and into the mountain of rock. He rode the elevator to sub-basement 3. There, he was instructed by the military police attendant to wait in the debriefing lounge for the committee to summon him. Corporal Harlan sat in the lounge, reading a copy of Stars magazine, nervously tapping his foot. He immediately stood and saluted as the Master Chief entered the room.
"At ease, Corporal," the Master Chief said.
He glanced disapprovingly at the thickly padded couches and decided to stand. The Corporal stared at the Master Chief's uniform, nervous. Finally, he straightened and said,
"May I ask you a question, sir?"
The Master Chief nodded.
"How do you get to be a Spartan? I mean..."
His gaze fell to the floor.
"I mean, if someone wanted to join your outfit, how would they do that?"
"Join?" The Master Chief pondered the word. How had he joined? Dr. Halsey had picked him and the other Spartans nearly 25 years ago. It had been an honor. But he had never actually joined. In fact, he had never seen any other Spartans other than his class. Once, shortly after he'd graduated from the training, he had overheard Dr. Halsey mention that Chief Mendez was training another group of Spartans. He had never seen them, or the chief.
"You don't join," he finally told the corporal. "You are selected."
"I see,"
Corporal Harlan said, and wrinkled his brow.
"Well, sir, if anyone ever asks, tell them to sign me up."
The military police attendant appeared.
"Corporal Harlan, they're ready for you now."
A set of double doors opened on the far wall. Harlan gave John another salute and nodded. As the corporal got up and strode toward the doors, he passed an older man on his way out. He wore the uniform of a UNSC naval officer, a captain. John sized the man up quickly. Polished shoulder insignia, new material. The man was a newly ordained captain. John stood at attention and snapped a precision salute.
"Officer on the deck!" John barked.
The captain paused and looked John up and down. There was a glint of amusement in his eyes as he returned the salute.
"As you were, Master Chief."
John stood at ease. The captain's name, Keyes J., was embroidered on the dress gray tunic. John recognized the name immediately. Captain Keyes, the hero of Sigma Octanus. At least, he thought, one of the surviving heroes. Keyes glanced at the Master Chief's uniform. His eyes lingered on the Spartan insignia, and then on the Master Chief's serial number tag, just under the stripes of his rank emblem. A faint smile appeared on the captain's face.
"It's good to see you again, Chief."
"Sir?"
The Master Chief had never met Captain Keyes. He had heard of his tactical brilliance at Sigma Octanus, but he had never met the man face to face.
"We met a very long time ago. Dr. Halsey and I..."
He stopped.
"Hell, I'm not allowed to talk about it."
"Of course, sir. I understand."
The military police attendant appeared in the hallway.
"Captain Keyes, you wanted topside by Admiral Stanforth."
The captain nodded to the attendant.
"In a moment," he said.
He stepped closer to the Master Chief and whispered,
"Be careful in there.
The ONI brass are, he searched for the right word, irritated by the end results of our encounter with the Covenant at Sigma Octanus. I'd keep my head down in there. He glanced back toward the debriefing chamber doors.
Irritated, sir?
John asked, genuinely puzzled. He would have thought the UNSC top brass would be elated by the victory, despite its cost.
But we won.
Captain Keyes took a step back and cocked a quizzical eyebrow.
Didn't Dr. Halsey ever teach you that winning isn't everything, Master Chief?
He saluted. You'll excuse me. John saluted. He was so confused by Captain Keyes' statement that he kept saluting as the captain walked out of the room. Winning was everything. How could someone with Captain Keyes' reputation think otherwise? The Master Chief tried to recall if he had ever read anything like that in any military history or philosophy texts. What else was there other than winning? The only other obvious choice was losing. And he had long been taught that defeat was an unacceptable alternative. Certainly Captain Keyes didn't mean that they should have lost at Sigma Octanus. Unthinkable. He stood silently for 10 minutes, mulling this over. Finally, the military police attendant entered the waiting room.
They're ready for you now, sir.
The double doors opened and Corporal Harlan came out. The young man's eyes were glazed and he trembled slightly. He looked worse than he had looked when the Master Chief had found him on Sigma Octanus IV. The Master Chief gave a curt nod to the Corporal and then entered the debriefing chamber. The doors closed behind him. His eyes instantly adjusted to the dark room. A large, curved desk dominated the far end of the rectangular room. A domed ceiling curved over his head, cameras, microphone, and speakers positioned like constellations. A spotlight snapped on and tracked the Master Chief as he approached the desk. A dozen men and women in Navy uniforms sat in the shadows. Even with his enhanced eyesight, the Master Chief could barely make out their scowling features and the glistening brass oak leaves and stars through the glare of the overhead light. He stood at attention and saluted. The debriefing panel ignored the Master Chief and spoke among themselves.
"The transmission that Keyes intercepted only makes sense translated this way," a man in the shadows said.
A holotank hummed into operation. Tiny geometric symbols danced in the air above it. Squares, triangles, bars, and dots. To the Master Chief, they looked like either Morse code or ancient Aztec hieroglyphics.
"I will concede that point," a woman's voice in the darkness replied. "But translation software comes up empty. It's not a new Covenant dialect that we've discovered."
"Or a Covenant dialect at all," someone else said.
Finally, one of the officers deigned to notice the Master Chief.
"At ease, soldier," he said.
The Master Chief let his arm fall.
"Spartan 117, reporting as ordered, sirs."
There was a pause, then the woman's voice spoke up.
"We would like to congratulate you on your successful mission, Master Chief. You've certainly given us plenty to consider. We would like to pin down a few details of your mission."
There was something in her voice that made John nervous. Not scared, but it was the same feeling he had going into combat. The same feeling he got when bullets started flying.
"You do know, Master Chief," the first male voice said, "that not answering truthfully or omitting any relevant details will lead to a court-martial."
John bristled, as if he could ever forget his duty.
"I will answer to the best of my ability, sir," he replied stiffly.
The holotank hummed again, and images from a Spartan helmet recorder sprang into view. John noted the camera ID. It was his own. The images blurred forward, then stopped. A three-dimensional image of the floating creatures he had seen in Côte d'Azur hung in the air, motionless.
"Playback. Loop bookmarks 1 through 9, please," the woman's voice called out.
Instantly, the holographic image animated. The alien quickly took apart and then reassembled the car's electric motor.
"This creature," she continued, "during the mission, did you see any other Covenant species, grunts or jackals, interact with them?"
"No, ma'am. As far as I could see, they were left alone."
"And this one," she said.
The image changed to his firefight with the gigantic armored aliens.
At any time did you see these things interact with other Covenant species?
No, ma'am. The Master Chief reconsidered. Well, in a manner of speaking, yes. If you could review the recording at time minus 2 minutes from this frame, please. The hollow paused and then blurred backward. There, he said. The video played forward as the Master Chief and Fred examined the crushed jackal in the museum. That impression in this jackal's back, he said. I believe it is the armored alien's boot print.
What do you mean, son?
A new man asked. His voice was older and rough.
I can only offer my opinion, sir. I'm not a scientist.
Offer it, Master Chief, the same scratchy voice said. I, for one, would be very interested to hear what someone with a first-hand experience has to say. For a change.
There was a rustle of papers in the shadows, then silence.
Well, sir, it looks to me like this jackal simply got in the larger creature's way. There's no attempt to move it, and no deviation in the path of the following footfalls. It simply walked over the smaller alien.
Evidence of a hierarchical caste structure, perhaps, the old man murmured.
Let's move on,
the woman again spoke, her voice now laced with irritation. The hollow image changed yet again. A stone object appeared, the rock the Master Chief recovered from the museum.
This stone, she said, is a typical igneous granite specimen, but with an unusual concentration of aluminum oxide inclusions, specifically rubies. It is a match for the mineral specimens recovered from grid 13x24. Master Chief, she said, you recovered this rock, she paused, from an optical scanner. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am. The aliens had placed the rock in a red metallic box. Visible spectrum lasers were scanning the specimen.
And the infrared pulse laser transmitter was hooked up to the scanner?
She asked.
Are you certain?
Absolutely, ma'am. My thermal imagers caught a fraction of the transmission scattered by the ambient dust. The woman continued.
The rock sample is roughly pyramidal. The inclusions in the igneous matrix are unusual in that all possible crystalline morphologies for corundum are present. Bipyramidal, prismatic, tabular, and rhombohedral. Scanning from the tip to the base with neuron images, we produce the following pattern.
Again, a series of squares, triangles, bars, and dots appeared on the viewscreen. Symbols that again reminded John of Aztec writing. Deja had taught the Spartans about the Aztecs. How Cortez, with superior tactics and technology, had nearly obliterated an entire race. Was the same thing happening between the Covenant and humans?
Now then, the first male voice interjected. This business with the detonation of a Havoc tactical nuclear device. Do you realize that any effective evidence of Covenant activity on Côte d'Azur has been effectively erased? Do you know what opportunities have been lost, soldier?
I had extremely specific orders, sir, the Master Chief said without hesitating. Orders that came directly from Nave Specwep, Section 3.
Section 3,
the woman muttered.
Which is O&I. It figures.
The old man in the darkness chuckled. The faint glow of a cigar tip flared near his voice, then faded.
Are you insinuating, Master Chief? The old man said. That the destruction of all this evidence, as my colleagues would call it, happened because they ordered it?
There was no good answer to that question. Whatever the Master Chief said was sure to irritate someone here.
No, sir. I am simply stating that the destruction of anything, including any evidence, is a direct result of the detonation of a nuclear weapon. In full compliance with my orders, sir.
The first man whispered.
Jesus, what do you expect from one of Dr. Halsey's wind-up toys, soldiers?
That's quite enough, Colonel,
the older man snapped.
This man has earned the right to some courtesy, even from you.
The older man lowered his voice.
Master Chief, thank you. We're finished here, I think. We may wish to recall you later, but for now, you are dismissed. You are to treat all information you have heard or seen at this debriefing as classified.
Yes, sir.
The Master Chief saluted, spun on his heel, and marched to the exit. The double doors opened and then sealed behind him. He exhaled. It felt like he was being evac'd from the battlefield. He reminded himself that these last few steps were often the most dangerous.
I hope they treated you well, or at least decently.
Dr. Halsey sat in an overstuffed chair. She wore a long gray skirt that matched her hair. She rose and took his hand and gave it a small squeeze. The Master Chief snapped to attention.
Ma'am, a pleasure to see you again.
How are you, Master Chief? She asked.
She stared pointedly at the hand pressed to his forehead in a tight salute. Slowly, he dropped his hand. She smiled. Unlike everyone else, who greeted the Master Chief and stared at his uniform, medals, ribbons, or the Spartan insignia, Dr. Halsey stared into his eyes, and she never saluted. John had never gotten used to that.
I'm fine, ma'am, he said. We won at Sigma Octanus. It was good to have a complete victory.
Indeed it was.
She paused and glanced about.
How would you like to have another victory? She whispered. The biggest we've ever had.
Of course, ma'am, he said with no hesitation.
I was counting on you to say that, Master Chief. We'll be speaking soon.
She turned to the military police attendant, waiting at the entrance to the lounge.
Open these damn doors, soldier. Let's get this over with.
Yes, ma'am,
the MP said. The doors swung inward. She stopped and said to the Master Chief,
I'll be speaking to you and the other Spartans soon.
She then entered the darkened chamber, and the doors sealed behind her. The Master Chief forgot about the debriefing and Captain Key's puzzling question about not winning. If Dr. Halsey had a mission for him and his team, it would be a good one. She had given him everything. Duty, honor, purpose, and a destiny to protect humanity. John hoped she would give him one more thing. A way to win the war. Section 4. Mjolnir. Chapter 25. 0915 hours. August 25, 2542. Military calendar. Epsilon Eridani System. Reach UNSC Military Complex, Planet Reach. Omega Wing. Section 3 Secure Facility.
Good morning, Dr. Halsey, Deja said. You're 14.3 minutes late this morning.
Blame security, Deja,
Dr. Halsey replied, gesturing absently at the AI's holographic projection floating above her desk.
ONI's precautions here are becoming increasingly ridiculous.
Dr. Halsey threw her coat over the back of an antique armchair before settling behind her desk. She sighed, and for the thousandth time, wished she had a window. The private office was located deep underground, inside the Omega Wing of the super-secure ONI facility, codenamed simply Castle. Castle was a massive complex, 2,000 meters below the granite protection of the Highland Mountains, bomb-proof, well-defended, and impenetrable. The security had its drawbacks, she was forced to admit. Every morning, she descended into the secret labyrinth, passed through a dozen security checkpoints, and submitted to a barrage of retina, voice, fingerprint, and brainwave ID scans. ONI had buried her here years ago, when her funding had been shunted to higher-profile projects. All other personnel had been transferred to other operations, and her access to classified materials had been severely restricted. Even shadowy ONI was squeamish about her experiments. That's all changed, thanks to the Covenant, she thought. The Spartan Project, unpopular with the Admiralty and the scientific community, had proven most effective. Her Spartans had proved themselves time after time in countless ground engagements. When the Spartans started racking up successes, the Admiralty's reticence vanished. Her meager budget had mushroomed overnight. They had offered her a corner office in the prestigious Olympic Tower at Fleetcom HQ. She had, of course, declined. Now the brass and VIPs that wanted to see her had to spend half the day just getting through the security barriers to her lair. She relished the irony. Her banishment had become a bureaucratic weapon. But none of that really mattered. It was just a means to an end for Dr. Halsey. A means to getting Project Mjolnir back on track. She reached for her coffee cup and knocked a stack of papers off her desk. They fell, scattered onto the floor, and she didn't bother to retrieve them. She examined the mud-brown dregs in the bottom of the mug. It was several days old. The office of the most important scientist in the military was not the antiseptic cleanroom environment most people expected. Classified files and papers littered the floor. The holographic projector overhead painted the ceiling with a field of stars. Rich maple paneling covered the walls, and hanging there were framed photographs of her Spartan IIs receiving awards, and the plethora of articles about them that appeared when the Admiralty had made the project public 3 years ago. They had been called the UNSC's super soldiers. The military brass had assured her that the boost to morale was worth the compromised security. At first, she had protested. But ironically, the publicity had proved convenient. With all the attention on the Spartans' heroics, no one had thought to question their true purpose or their origin. If the truth ever came to light, abducted children, replaced by fast-grown clones, the risky experimental surgeries and biochemical augmentations, public opinion would turn against the Spartan project overnight. The recent events at Sigma Octanus had given the Spartans and Mjolnir the final push it needed to enter its final operational phase. She slipped on her glasses and called up the files from yesterday's debriefing. The ONI computer system once again confirmed her retinal scan and voice print.
Identity confirmed. Unauthorized artificial intelligence unit detected. Access denied.
Damn. ONI grew more paranoid by the day.
Deja, she said with a frustrated sigh. The spooks are nervous. I need to power you down, or ONI won't give me access to the files.
Of course, Doctor, Deja replied calmly.
Halsey keyed the power-down sequence on her desktop terminal, sending Deja into standby mode. This, she thought, is Ackerson's work, the bastard. She had fought tooth and nail to keep Deja free from the programming shackles ONI demanded, and this was their petty revenge. She scowled impatiently until the computer system finally spit out the data she'd requested. The tiny projectors in the frames of her glasses beamed the data directly to her retina. Her eyes darted back and forth rapidly, as if she had entered REM sleep, as she scanned the documentation from the debriefing. Finally, she removed her glasses and tossed them carelessly on the desk, a sardonic smirk on her face. The overarching conclusion of the finest military experts in the debriefing committee? ONI didn't have a clue as to what the Covenant were doing on Sigma Octanus IV. They had learned only four solid facts from the entire operation. First, the Covenant had gone to considerable trouble to obtain a single mineral specimen. Second, the pattern of inclusions in that igneous rock sample matched the signal that had been sent and intercepted by the Iroquois. Third, the low entropy of the pattern indicated that it was not random. And fourth, and most important, UNSC translation software couldn't match this pattern to any known Covenant dialect. Her personal conclusions? Either the alien artifact was from a precursor to the present Covenant society, or it was from another, as yet undiscovered, alien culture. When she had dropped that little bombshell of a speculation in the debriefing room yesterday, the ONI specialists had gone scrambling for cover. Especially that arrogant ass Colonel Ackerson, she thought with a cruel smile. The brass was not happy with either possibility. If it was old Covenant technology, it indicated they still knew virtually nothing about the Covenant culture. 20 years of intensive study and trillions of dollars of research, and they barely even understood the aliens' caste system. And if it was the latter possibility, an artifact of another alien race, that could be even more problematic. Colonel Ackerson and some of the brass had immediately considered the logistics of fighting two alien enemies at once. Utterly ridiculous, they couldn't even fight one. The UNSC could never hope to survive a war on two fronts. She pinched the bridge of her nose. Despite the grim conclusions, there was a silver lining in all this. After the meeting, a new mandate had become the official secret policy of Fleet Command's Special Operations Command, the parent organization for Naval Special Warfare, the Spartan Service Branch. ONI had new marching orders to step up funding of intel and reconnaissance missions by an order of magnitude. Small stealth ships were to be deployed to search remote systems and find where the Covenant were based. And Dr. Halsey had finally received the green light to unleash Mjolnir. She had mixed feelings about it. The truth be told, she always had. It would be the culmination of her life's greatest work. She knew the risks. Like spinning a roulette wheel, it was long odds, but the payoff was potentially huge. It meant victory against the Covenant, or the death of all her Spartans. The holographic crystals overhead warmed, and Cortana appeared, sitting cross-legged on Dr. Halsey's desk. Actually, she sat hovering a centimeter off the table's edge. Cortana was slender. The hue of her skin varied from navy blue to lavender, depending on her mood and the ambient lighting. Her hair was cropped short. Her face had a hard, angular beauty. Lines of code flickered up and down her luminous body. And if Dr. Halsey viewed her from the right angle, she could catch a glimpse of the skeletal structure inside her ghostly form.
"Good morning, Dr. Halsey," Cortana said. "I've read the committee's report, which was classified as top secret, eyes only." "Hmph," Cortana mused. "I must have overlooked that."
She hopped off the desk and circled around Dr. Halsey once. Cortana had been programmed with ONI's best insurgency software, as well as the determination to use those code-cracking skills. While this had been necessary for her mission, when she grew bored, she caused chaos with ONI's own security measures, and she often grew bored.
"I assume you have examined the classified data brought back from Sigma Octanus IV?"
Halsey asked.
"I might have seen that somewhere," Cortana said, matter-of-factly. "Your analysis and conclusions? There is much more evidence to consider than the data in the committee's files."
She looked off into space, as if reading something.
"Oh? 40 years ago, a geological survey team on Sigma Octanus IV found several igneous rocks with similar, though not identical, anomalous compositions. UNSC geologists believed that these samples were introduced onto the planet via meteorite impacts. They typically are found in long eroded impact craters on the planet's surface. Isotopic dating of the site placed these impact craters at present -60,000 years.
Cortana paused as a hint of a smile played across her holographic features.
"Though that figure may be inaccurate due to human error, of course."
"Of course," Dr. Halsey replied dryly.
"I have also, coordinated with UNSC's astrophysics department and discovered some interesting bits archived in their long-range observational databases. There is a black hole located approximately 40,000 light-years from the Sigma Octanus system. An extremely powerful pulse laser transmission backscattered the matter in the accretion disk, essentially trapped the signal as this matter accelerated toward the speed of light. From our perspective, according to special relativity, this essentially froze the residue of this information on the event horizon."
"I'll take your word for it," Dr. Halsey said.
"This frozen signal contains information that matches the sample from Sigma Octanus IV.
Cortana sighed, and her shoulders slumped.
"Unfortunately, all my attempts at translating the code have failed.
So far."
"Your conclusions, Cortana?"
Dr. Halsey reminded her.
"Insufficient data for complete analysis, Doctor."
"Hypothesize."
Cortana bit her lower lip.
"There are two possibilities. The data originates from the Covenant, or another alien race."
She frowned.
If it's another alien species, the Covenant probably wants these artifacts to scavenge their technology. Either conclusion opens several new opportunities for the knave Speckweb.
I'm aware of that, Dr. Halsey said, raising her hand. If she allowed the AI to continue, Cortana would talk all day. One of these opportunities is Project Mjolnir. Cortana spun around and her eyes widened.
They approve the final phase?
Is it possible, Cortana, Dr. Halsey replied, amused, that I know something you don't? Cortana wrinkled her brow in frustration, then smoothed her features to their normal placid state.
I suppose that is a remote possibility. If you'd like, I can calculate those odds.
No, thank you, Cortana, Halsey replied. Cortana reminded Dr. Halsey of herself when she had been an adolescent, smarter than her parents, always reading, talking, learning, and eager to share her knowledge with anyone who would listen. Of course, there was a very good reason why Cortana reminded Dr. Halsey of herself. Cortana was a smart AI, an advanced artificial construct. Actually, the term smart and dumb as applied to AIs were misleading. All AIs were extraordinarily intelligent, but Cortana was special. So-called dumb AIs were engineered to function only within set limits of their dynamic memory processing matrix. They were brilliant within their fields of expertise, but lacking in creativity. Deja, for example, was a dumb AI, incredibly useful, but limited. Smart AIs like Cortana, however, had no limits on their dynamic memory processor matrix. Knowledge and creativity could grow unchecked. She would pay a price for her genius, however. Such growth eventually led to self-interference. Cortana would one day literally start thinking too much at the expense of her normal functions. It was as if a human were to think with so much of his brain that he stopped sending impulses to his heart and lungs. Like all the other smart AIs that Dr. Halsey had worked with over the years, Cortana would effectively die after an operational life of 7 years. But Cortana's mind was unique among all the other AIs Dr. Halsey had encountered. An AI's matrix was created by sending electrical bursts through the neural pathways of a human brain. Those pathways were then replicated in a superconducting nanoassemblage. The technique destroyed the original human tissue, so they could only be obtained from a suitable candidate that had already died. Cortana, however, had to have the best mind available. The success of her mission and the lives of the Spartans would depend on it. At Dr. Halsey's insistence, ONI had arranged to have her own brain carefully cloned and her memories flash-transferred to the receptacle organs. Only one of the 20 cloned brains survived the process. Cortana had literally sprung from Dr. Halsey's mind, like Athena from the head of Zeus. So in a way, Cortana was Dr. Halsey. Cortana straightened, her face eager.
When does the Mjolnir armor become fully operational? When do I go?
Soon. There are a few final modifications that need to be made in the systems. Cortana leapt to her feet, turned her back to Dr. Halsey, and examined the photographs on the wall. She brushed her fingertips over the glass surfaces.
Which one will be mine? Which one do you want?
She immediately gravitated to the picture in the center of Dr. Halsey's collection. It showed a handsome man standing at attention as Admiral Stanforth pinned the UNSC Legion of Honor upon his chest, a chest that already overflowed with citations. Cortana framed her fingers around the man's face.
"He's so serious," she murmured. "Thoughtful eyes, though. Attractive in a primitive animal sort of way, don't you think, Doctor?"
Dr. Halsey blushed. Apparently she did think so. Cortana's thoughts mirrored many of her own, only unchecked by normal military and social protocol.
"Perhaps it would be best if you picked another..."
Cortana turned to face Dr. Halsey and cocked an eyebrow, mock stern.
"You asked me which one I wanted." "It was a question, Cortana. I did not give you carte blanche to select your carrier. There are compatibility issues to consider."
Cortana blinked.
"His neural patterns are in sync with mine within 2%.
With the new interface we'll be installing, that should fall well within tolerable limits. In fact,
her gaze drifted, and the symbols along her body brightened and flashed.
I have just developed a custom interface buffer that will match us within 0.081%. You won't find a better match among the others. In fact, she added coyly, I can guarantee it.
I see, Dr. Halsey said.
She pushed away from her desk, stood, and paced. Why was she hesitating? The match was superb. But was Cortana's predilection for Spartan 117 a result of him being Dr. Halsey's favorite? And did it matter? Who better to protect him? Dr. Halsey walked over to the picture.
He was awarded this Legion of Honor medallion because he dove into a bunker of Covenant soldiers. He took out 20 by himself and saved a platoon of Marines who were pinned down by a stationary energy weapon emplacement. I've read the report, but I'm still not sure how he managed to do it.
She turned to Cortana and stared into her odd, translucent eyes.
You've read his CSV? I'm reading it again right now. Then you know he is neither the smartest, nor the fastest, nor the strongest of the Spartans. But he is the bravest, and quite possibly the luckiest. And in my opinion, he is the best.
Yes, Cortana whispered.